This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 243 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and you're going to have to get over that.
I can't. Well, now, okay, sorry. I was going to say something, but we're almost there. You got to finish your intro.
And we are in love with all things Outlander.
We don't normally have announcements. We have a place for announcements, just right at the top. But it's not really, I guess it is an announcement. It wasn't formally made by Stars, but it was made, I believe, by Ron or someone in an interview. And that interview was during, in the prelude, as we're coming up to the Emmys. And a whole bunch of press was done. And Ron Moore basically informally announced or confirmed that we are getting season 5 of Outlander. Of course, that's everyone's favorite book, The Fiery Cross.
Oh, God. Can they combine that with something else and cut out all the awful?
Stop it. You don't want to combine this stuff. That's dangerous territory. But that's a whole thing. Well, okay. So the reason I say that, and I kind of make light of it, it's a positive negative thing. Every time we get another year, it means, I'm going to knock on wood.
That's not wood.
It's my desk. It is my table. It is wood.
Sounded like you knocked on the microphone.
Oh no, it was my table. So knock on wood. It means that obviously we got the season, which means before the season, we do the read along and knock on wood. And if, I don't know what the religious equivalent is, like they're not there before the grace of God, but what do you say? Like if God willing, we will have trips to Comic-Con and all the things we normally do. Okay. But it's positive. It's not negative. There's nothing necessarily negative about it. Like, it's not bad. But I grin and I cringe.
So you cringe?
Pretty much. I cringe. is that a new hashtag now?
Sure is.
Gringer. Is it Gringer Ginger? Sorry. Or Ginger Gringe.
No, that's way too close to that drag queen, Ginger Minge.
Oh, Lord, Ginger Minge. Yeah, no thanks. So the reason it's funny is not funny. It's kind of sad, but I don't mean, I'm not asking for sympathy. I know we won't get any. It's just,
episode you asked for this.
5 years ago, I did not ask for this.
You asked for this when you came up with the bright idea to do an Outlander podcast.
That didn't exist. Nothing existed. And now there's a quadrillion of us, them, and we're the only nutty ones that are weekly. Oh my gosh. Okay, so we already given the announcement. The reason I cringe is because, as awesome as it is, because in the end, the most important thing, or the thing that we of course love, is to see our beloved series adapted. Of course, that is like what everyone loves to see, or we hope loves to see. And then the deal that we made to ourselves, and now to many of our listeners and friends, is that we'll do a chapter by chapter read along of each book before the season starts.
Hey, I've gone further than that. Oh. I've gone further than that and stated that even if they cancel the series, we're finishing the read along.
Yes, but then it's on our schedule.
Yes.
And we can do like twice a month.
You spend a third of your life in your sheets. They make a difference with how you sleep. Start getting better sleep with the best sheets.
Brooklinen.com has the best, most comfortable sheets. No big markup.
When I got my new Brooklinen bedding, I selected the deluxe comforter duvet set, and I did a mix and match. So I had the duvet cover and two of the pillows in the reverse smoke stripes, which is a cream base with a light charcoal kind of a stripe on them. And I did not anticipate how much more amazing being in my bed was going to be.
I chose all white bedding so I could mix and match with my other pieces. And the feel of these sheets is amazing. So soft, so smooth. I fall right to sleep.
So Brooklinen.com was founded in April of 2014 by husband and wife team Vicky and Rich Fullup. Their philosophy was to create the most beautiful, comfortable home essentials with no crazy prices.
That's right. Brooklinen was named the winner of the best of online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. You can mix and match to complement any decor with their versatile colors and patterns.
Brooklinen is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. My Brooklinen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've slept on.
Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Outlander at Brooklinen.com.
Brooklinen is so confident that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code Outlander.
Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. To find out more and how to participate, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are discussing Chapter 23 of Drums of Autumn, entitled The Skull Beneath the Skin.
Spring 1768. Duncan returns with 8 former Ardsmuir men and their families, ready to homestead on the ridge. That would make a total of 30 people. Claire the healer is back in business.
Do you think he worked harder to bring more families because he doesn't have a hand?
I don't know. You mean if he didn't have...
He's missing a hand. I'm like, I'm just wondering if... Because he brought a bunch of people. That's a lot of people.
I don't think he, but he didn't bring 30.
Well, no, but he's one dude.
I don't think he worked necessarily harder because he had one arm. I think that if he had two arms, he would have stayed back. I mean, he still could have been a helper in the same way. But I think he would have stayed. Well, no, I guess it would have had to be him because two arms or one arm, he knew the Ardsmuir men and whoever... That was the reason that he was sent. Otherwise, Jamie would have had to go. I don't know. I don't think necessarily, but I could see him wanting to perform more because he was given this opportunity through Jamie. Claire the healer is back in business with all of these bodies to take care of. Her magical ways become known farther and farther afield, and she goes along to heal and deliver babies where necessary. She also took the odd trip to Anauka from time to time to see her friend, Nyawene. So by now, they on the ridge had horses, mules, chickens, a, quote, depraved-looking black boar to meet the social needs of the pig, unquote, and a milk goat. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking social needs of the pig means the mating needs, correct? Also social because pigs are social, specifically because they want baby piglets.
I guess they do, but I bet it was a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Because, for instance, my dad, who is also your dad.
Really?
Yeah. Strange that. Always used to say that if you had the money and you got a horse, get a second horse. But if you can't get a second horse, get a goat.
Huh.
And the goat and the horse will keep each other company.
That's hysterical.
So I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Well, that pig got a second pig and a goat. So she had to make some of her healing trips on her own. Since there were so many more animals to look after, they couldn't like abandon the place. She's still taking her notes in Daniel Rawlings' casebook. They get gifts of food from her patients' families as payment. Though hardly anyone spoke English or even French, they were able to communicate effectively enough and get the gist of where does it hurt across. So that was by spring. So by August 1768, Claire has been to visit a family called the Müllers, a German family, and where she had delivered a baby. There is this monster storm going on, and the creek had risen quite dangerously. She likely ought to have stayed at the Müllers for through the storm at least, but she couldn't stand the thought of being caught there. So she and her horse brave the rising creek. The horse freaking swims across, and they make it. This is a horse that Jamie had gotten her, and I think actually from the German family, and she hasn't named it yet. And apparently the name that it came with, or the name that the German family told Jamie it had, Jamie refused to translate. So must not have been the nicest name or nicest word. They come to where the trail was, the trail home, but it was now washed away by the rain. She retraces her steps and looks for another way around. Don't forget, it is pissing down rain right now. All of this in the rain, in the thick rain. She finds a place where she might be able to cross, and the rain turns into hail. The horse freaks out, and she takes it to a tree for shelter. Then the lightning comes, and Claire is doing the one hippopotamus, two hippopotamus.
Do you know where I learned that?
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
Poltergeist.
Absolutely. But it wasn't hippopotamus.
It was just 1/1000.
I think it was.
But still, the whole counting from the lightning strike to the thunder. That was something that I totally learned from Poltergeist, the movie. I had never heard that before.
Me either. Me too. And I want to know how many of you listeners were children of any, I mean, you don't have to be our exact ages or even within like five, well, probably within 5 years of us. But anyway, how many children of the 80s or those who were in their childhood or maybe, you know, young, early teens, no later than maybe early teens, learned that or remember that specific scene from Poltergeist? I would love to hear from you guys.
And how many of you just found out about that trick by reading this chapter?
From Claire and Diana. So as the storm gets closer and the lightning gets closer and more dangerous, lightning strikes closer and closer, the horse freaks out and bolts and she falls. When she kind of like, not stands up, but like looks around and can kind of get her bearings, the horse is gone. Well, actually, the horse isn't too far away. They had been standing on at a precipice. And when the horse bolted, it had noticed the danger and refrained from going further. Claire, however, had been thrown over the edge.
I hate it when that happens.
She wasn't able to see a way back up. No one knew where she was, right? Because the Müllers think she's gone home, knows that she was with the Müllers, but he probably thinks, you know, oh my gosh, of course she's going to, you know, stay with the Müllers in this storm. So she shelters under the roots of a fallen red cedar. The space she finds was about 5 feet by 5 feet, the ceiling made up of the tree's roots and earth, the floor of damp earth. She takes her shoes off and puts them beside her in the furthest corner. And shivering here and there, she's able to get some kind of fitful sleep. Her dreams are of giving birth, having no pain, but she sees the head of the child, quote, as though I stood between my own thighs, midwife and mother both together, unquote. She gave the baby to Frank, but it was Jamie who took the call from her face and said, she's beautiful.
That visual broke my brain. I had to listen to that segment about 3 times before I fully was able to envision what she was talking about.
That like Frank turned into Jamie, basically?
No, about her being the midwife and standing between her own legs and delivering her own baby, but both at the same time.
She practices a lot of yoga.
Seriously.
So her dream continues. She is lost, finding her way to some place. She woke and slept and then woke to the smell of burning. The rain had stopped. She goes out of her hidey hole and it's nearly dark. A tree had been struck by lightning. She looks back for her shoes, but she doesn't see them. She crawls up the ridge toward the burnt tree. Now, even though it was no longer burning, it was steaming and it was quite warm there. And she sees there's now no sign of the horse. As it's getting darker and as the tree's warmth recedes, she decides to go back to the hollow to spend the night. Quote, crawling in, I saw a pale blur against the darker earth in the corner, unquote. She reaches out for it, and it's hard and smooth. She realizes what it was before she can form the word for it. It was a skull, complete with lower jaw, mandible, and from the feeling of it, she believes it was likely a man and not an old one. Most of the teeth were present and not unduly worn. She thinks this person had been dead longer than 9 years. Her instincts tell her that he had met a violent end. Quote, the Cherokee and Tuscarora buried their dead, unquote. But not like this, alone in a hollow, and not in pieces. The broken bits of vertebra had clean, broken edges, and they were not shattered. It seems he was likely beheaded.
She has a knack for finding, and it not finding. She didn't find the first one. That was kind of just, you know, say, hey, look at this.
She created the first one.
She did. She did. My point is that she has a lot of experience with decapitated skulls.
And so she began to dig for the rest of him. She's like, look, I got nothing else better to do. Can't sleep. I have weird, funky yoga, weirdo dreams, contortionist dreams. So may as well dig this dude up. She finds something hard, but it's not bone. It was oval shaped. She put the stone in her pocket. She starts to talk to the skull. She surprises herself and thinks, why am I assuming this person was a European? It could have been a native. She sees a light outside growing into a flame, and it moved. Quote, it glided slowly down the hill toward me, floating just above the bushes. Unquote. She's freaking out. She still had no shoes on, and she still can't find her shoes. She faces the light, holding the skull. The light comes closer. It wasn't flickering, rather glowing. A few feet above the ground. Quote, I could see it bob slightly, moving to the rhythm of a steady stride. Unquote. And this was not St. Elmo's fire. She had seen that before. And then she sees him. Quote, he was tall and he was naked. Beyond a breech clout, he wore nothing but paint. Long stripes of red down arms and legs and torso, and his face was solid black from chin to forehead. His hair was greased and dressed in a crest from which two turkey feathers stiffly pointed. Unquote. She could see the detail of him. He knew she was there. He stood there staring at where she was. She asks a bit later, quote, whatever do you want? And then she says, what do you want? I can't do anything for you. I know you're there. I can see you, but that's all. That's enough, it said. Then it turned and walked away. Its light disappeared. So by this time, Claire is no longer afraid. She's still cold, but not afraid. She curls up with the skull and falls asleep. As you do. And she dreams fitfully of lying in the rain. More sleep and more dreams, this time with wolves in the distance, a man with his head plucked bald with deep eyes and shattered smile, blood on his breast. And then the wolves were closer. She's running with the wolves, and then from them, quote, I felt my arm bone crack with a noise like a dry branch snapping, and tasted marrow warm and salty, slippery on my tongue, unquote. She's experiencing the hunt and the hunted. She's fighting with the beast. She's trying to escape from one, and then she sees that it's Dawn and it's Rollo. Jamie pulls her up out of the hollow. So basically, at this point, all we know is that she's fitfully awoken from a dream, and Rollo's there. She sees him, and she sees Jamie. Jamie pulls her up out of the hollow. He took her to the stream where she could clean up. And then young Ian pipes up. He found the skull. She says she doesn't know who it is, but he's a nice chap. And not to let Rollo get it. Do you have a hard time finding the perfect fitting jeans that are also comfortable? Let us tell you about True Religion.
Now, I'm not one to normally order my clothes online because I never really know how they're going to fit when they arrive. So I was a little nervous ordering, especially jeans. I know how hard it is to find good jeans and jeans that fit you well when you're out and about. So I was a little nervous when they arrived, but I should not have been nervous. They fit perfectly right out of the box and are the softest, darkest, and they've retained their color jeans that I have purchased to date.
And I selected a beautiful beige wool sweater that fits really well. It's very fashionable too. It's going into my suitcase for our upcoming trip to Scotland.
So why True Religion? Well, they carefully craft everything from design to wash. True Religion jeans are made with softer fabric that keeps its shape and won't fade.
True Religion believes that no matter your body type or your style, there's a true fit for you. Their jeans range from skinny, high-rise, bootcut, straight, and retro-inspired wide leg.
Are you ready to get the most perfect-fitting, most comfortable, most flattering pair of jeans? Right now, True Religion is giving our listeners 20% off your entire purchase when you use our code OUTLANDER at checkout.
So do what we did and go to truereligion.com and enter our code OUTLANDER for 20% off your entire order.
So her dreams that she's having in this hollow or whatever, she's dreaming about basically being all things all the time. I mean,
I see what you're saying. I didn't make that link before, but yeah. So the first one that we learn about or get from Diana description is that she's experiencing the birth of her daughter as both the one giving birth and the one assisting in the birth, I guess, like catching the child. Yes. As well as seeing both Frank and Jamie. And then in this next dream, or at least the last one, it's she's experiencing being the wolf, right? Being with the wolves, of the wolves, as well as being hunted by the wolves. Yeah. So it's a lot of yoga contortion. Yes. So Jamie gives her some brandy wine, though he has no food, unfortunately. She tells him the horse's name is Judas since he betrayed her and since she's been alone since the horse left. About noon the day before was when that happened. And it was Rollo, we find out, who led them to Claire. If they didn't find the horse, how did they know to look for her? Or certainly where? Jamie goes on about her feet. They're frozen. Where did you lose your shoes? And she says, back in the hollow. They must be there or near the creek, but they aren't. So Jamie and Young Ian and Rollo were at home and inside the cabin, and Rollo was going nuts. Not just like, oh, there's a noise and I'm gonna, you know, bark, bark, woof, woof, let me out. No, he went apeshes. I mean, he was like drooling or spraying. He was going crazy.
They probably thought he was going rabid if he was spraying and
exactly,
foaming at the mouth.
And they finally let him outside. But when they looked, there was nothing there. Nothing except Claire's shoes sitting on the doorstep side by side.
Who moved the shoes?
Rollo took off and then came back whimpering. Rollo led them off and led them straight to her. Jamie, who has her shoes, brought them with him, puts them on her feet.
Here's what I thought about the shoes. Well, not the whole shoes. I had lots of thoughts about the shoes. That, you know, that section of the book always gives me like mad chills all up and down my body. But he was carrying her shoes in his sporran, I believe, if I remember correctly. She's either got super tiny feet or he's got a gigantic sporran.
So Summer is thinking of, oh my gosh, how did they fit? Or does she really have that small of feet? And everyone else is like, how the F did those shoes get
well,
there?
Well, clearly that was also in there. That was also part of my thought process. But I remembered thinking as he pulled the shoes out of his sporran, like sporrans to me don't look that large. Like you could put baby shoes in a sporran for sure. But I have not seen a sporran to date that could hold a set of size 10 shoes.
I don't think Clara had a size 10, but as far as yours or mine, yes.
I mean, could you imagine the spore and it would need to hold my shoes? Huge.
Wow. Yeah, it would have to be some kind of beaver.
Wow. Don't talk about my beaver.
Claire asks them if they saw anything on the way. Nope. So they make their way back to the ridge. She says that they could take him home and give him, meaning the skull, and give him a Christian burial. Jamie doesn't think he's a Christian. She pulls out the stone that was buried with him and gasps. Quote, the flattened face was indeed incised with a carving. It was a glyph in the shape of a spiral. And it was an opal. A huge one. Jamie says that opals are unlucky stones. He's not keen on having it with them. Young Ian adds, it's more that the opal takes on something from its owner. If it was a good person, great. If not, they keep it because it likely has value.
See, now what I had always heard about opals is that they were bad luck to own if they were not your birthstone.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's what I had heard. And I owned, like, I think mom maybe one year bought me a ring that had an opal in it. And I kid you not, the opal popped out of that ring. It was like having none of me because it's not my birthstone.
None of me. Why not take none of me?
It did. It took absolutely none of me.
Can't you see? You're no good with me.
Can't you see? Can't you see? I am not your birthstone.
Take my lips.
There's no lips.
I'll never use them. Speaking of beaver, I'm just kidding.
Please stop.
Oh, Lord.
Anyway, I digress. Opals.
Claire wants to show the stone to Nyawene. So they get the horses and get Claire up for the rest of the way home. There's smoke coming from the cabin, and Jamie had said that he'd smored the fire, so someone's been there. And Judas had shown up after all. So Judas, okay. I mean, what an asshole of a horse. But at least he doesn't get lost. They don't lose him.
I forgot the horse's name was suggested to be Judas, and you were like, and Judas showed up. And I was like, wow, he was uninvited. No one invites Judas to parties on the ridge.
So the visitor had to be a friend or just a really nice enemy, I guess, because he'd fed the animals. And of course, it was a friend. It was Duncan Innes. He'd brought Judas in. Jamie takes Claire to bed for sleep, and she wants to bathe first. They have like a, not quite a throwdown, but almost a throwdown. He's like, bed, move, new. And she's like, no bath.
Dude, I would completely be on her side. And the reasoning being is that she will, if she does not take a bath tonight, tomorrow she will have to do all the laundry and bath.
If she dirtied the sheets, that's more laundry.
Yeah. It's one towel versus whatever she's got as sheets for her bed. And I guarantee you the one towel would be a lot quicker to wash or launder from start to finish than all of the bedclothes.
Jamie helps her clean and they wash her hair. As they chat about what happened to her, he's quite annoyed. He'd been very afraid for her. She says, why don't you scold me in Gaelic? It'll ease your feelings just as much and I'll only understand half of what you say. So...
well, clearly the half he was speaking to her was the half she already knew.
So he does. And then he starts to describe things that he'd like to do to her. He rubs camphor oil onto her chest. And that's not something he describes. That's what he actually does. And she tells him that what, and they don't fight, but he definitely like overpowers her to make sure he gets it on. And she tells him that wet clothes and being cold did not cause sickness because he's worried about her. That's part of the, I think, part of the bathing thing, too. She's like, you can't get sick from being wet or cold. And she says it's germs. She puts on her shift and then gets into bed and they go to town. Now, remember, this is still when this is not the big house yet, right?
No.
Okay. So this is which not a spoiler. I'm not going to say what that means. They're still, and they've described it here. They're still in the cabin where it's Jamie and Claire's bed that Jocasta gave them, or the mattress anyway. And then Ian's on a trundle. And then Duncan spends the night like in front of the hearth or something. So like literally there's everybody's in the same room. So they're going to town means there's no one else in there. Young Ian tries to
Wait. Because what's funny, one of the things I remembered from reading that scene of where he's like greasing her down with the whatever the camphor oil, whatever that she had previously greased him with, is that she gets all randy from his ministrations. And he's like, I didn't have this kind of a response when you rubbed me down with it. Which that was funny. But I was thinking about it and I was like, well, she probably applies it matter of factly. And it's just like very like surgical about it. Like, this is going on your body and I'm done. I'm doing this purely to rub this on your body for health reasons. Whereas when he did it, he probably had a more gentle touch, maybe a little more, you know, coaxing. I don't know. Just a thought.
So young Ian, he's so proud of himself for having made this barley crowdy. He dishes some up for her and he's so proud. And she suggests that, oh, why don't you try, you know, I'll have a little bit of this and why don't you go out and let's try to bag a squirrel. Let's go get some protein. And he goes happily. The skull is happily sitting on her writing desk, all cozy. And she realizes she hasn't written the account of the newest Muno's birth. So she gets up to do so. She pours Ian's barley soup back into the pot and she begins to spread the bag of barley to dry, the barley out of the bag to dry. She hears Duncan and Jamie chatting. Now, Jocasta had given Duncan a horse and Jamie has an opinion about that. And not just a horse, like, here's a horse. It was a gentle horse. I do appreciate that from Jocasta. Number one, it helps to have a horse, right? Because your transportation. Number two, specifically the horse was selected for him because she was so gentle. And someone like Duncan was, well, having one arm, it's, you don't want an asshole horse, right? You don't want Judas. So they're discussing, Jamie and Duncan, whether it'll be Sinclair the cooper or Geordie Chisholm the farmer to set up at the ridge. Now, Sinclair would take more money as a cooper with a cooper's shop to set up, whereas Geordie would need fewer supplies. So Jocasta has also sent a gift for Jamie through Duncan. It's a bottle of whiskey, and it seems to soothe things between them for now. So between Geordie and Sinclair, the cooper would be very valuable to have. Their shop would provide a close place for people to get supplies. But as I said, it would be expensive. We begin to see Jamie's overarching plan besides setting up on the ridge. His goal is to find all of the Ardsmuir men. Quote, Gavin Hayes was the first, and we had done for him all that we could done, seen him safe into heaven's keeping. Two more were known dead, one of fever, one of drowning. Three had completed their terms of indenture, and, armed with only the axe and suit of clothes that were a bondsman's final pay, had managed to find a foothold for themselves, claiming backcountry land and carving out small homesteads there. Of the remainder, we had brought 20 so far to settle on good land near the river under Jamie's sponsorship. Another was feeble-minded, but worked for one of the others as a hired man and so earned his keep. Unquote. So what they did to get money, to get supplies, was that they had gone to their acquaintances and Jamie collected some money in Cross Creek, their acquaintances in Cross Creek. And then he just straight up gambled for like 3 days straight, hardly slept, and he quadrupled the money. He returned their money with a little bit of interest, leaving them with enough to get seed corn for planting and an extra mule for plowing and a goat and some pigs. Now, Summer, when she was describing what they had done to get that money, was that what they had done to start on the ridge, or was that what they had done to start setting up is that how they decided to do something with the cooper shop? Because it sounded like the whole point about choosing between Sinclair, although they may, the bulk or a higher number of people would benefit from something like a cooper shop, it was much more expensive to set up. And the whole point was they were cash poor because even to get what they had at that point, whether it was supplies or getting people there or getting their own stuff, what they had to do to get that left them with almost nothing.
I feel like it was might have been time to start purchasing some glass windows.
Oh, gosh. With what money?
Exactly. How else are they going to get the money? Like almost everything else they can get from the land.
That's true.
Like all the trees are there. They can build almost everything out of trees. Like the roof, the shingles, the walls, the floor. All those things can be made with wood and or rocks from gathered from the area. However, they cannot forage glass windows.
That's true. At least not yet. As she thinks of all the people that Jamie was now responsible for, we learn that Fergus and Marsali were back from Jamaica with wee Germaine. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. He was a wee chubby blonde haired child that basically had Fergus wrapped around his little finger. In the palm of his hand is what Diana put it.
The one, only one. The one hand.
Oh Lord.
Yeah, wrapped one around, hand. Wrapped around his hook.
Diana, that was really bad. I didn't even realize it. Fergus and Marsali's cabin was about a mile from theirs. Claire is lonely for Bree. And little Germaine, quote, was a substitute for the grandchild I would never hold, unquote. So as she's writing the case of the Mueller's baby's birth, she remembers the call, but not that baby's call. It was her dream. It was Brianna who had been born with a call. Now, the Scots, I love this. The Scots called it a silly hoo.
That just sounds like foreskin.
It meant a lucky hood. It was a protection from drowning later in life.
Yeah, a lucky hood. Well, like that, a, I mean, like a, I think that like is a equally
name for foreskin?
Appropriate.
Oh, that. I thought you meant a silly hoo. I think I like silly hoo for this episode. Or how about silly hoo does not mean foreskin? Yeah, maybe not. Okay, so what the silly hoo meant was that protection, or what they believed it, it was protection from drowning later in life, and that some were born with the second sight. Quote, whether lucky or not, Brianna had never shown any signs of that strange Celtic knowing, and I thought it just as well. I knew enough of my own peculiar form of second sight, the certain knowledge of things to come, not to wish its complications on anyone else, unquote. So she misses Brianna, but she wouldn't wish her here in this harsh world. Finished with her notes, she picks up the skull. She had always had an affinity for bones, as Summer already reminded us. Now, this reminds me of Master Raymond's collection. Of course, I wrote that down before I went back to the chapter and read, and like Diana like spills on about Master Raymond. The apothecary shop, she remembers his words, quote, sympathy? It is an unusual emotion to feel for a bone, Madonna. And they are company of a sort. As she raises the skull's teeth to the light to examine it, she sees that on one side they had been shattered. The other side was whole. She thought that he was in his late 30s, early 40s, and his teeth were hardly worn. And then she sees it.
Dun, dun, dun.
Quote, I turned the skull over to judge the abrasion of the molars and stopped cold, for the late sun now struck sparks from my hands. From the silver band of my wedding ring and from the silver fillings in my late companion's mouth, unquote. In their few minutes together before Duncan comes back in, she tells Jamie. She tells him it was another TT and there must be another place. Of course, place with a capital P. Maybe nearby. So another stone circle. And they plan to bury the skull after supper. Now, besides the things and like the storyline and continuing advancing and things that happen, we have a very important, and it happens every, at least happens once or twice a book. But this is the first time. Oh, it's not true. This is the third thing. So for the first two books of Outlander, of the series, so the first two, gosh, for almost three full books, we, I think, especially if it's your first time reading, we are under the opinion, we are of the opinion that Karaina Dunn is the time traveling mecca, right? That, or at least it is the place in Diana's universe where it happens. And then at the end of Voyager, we are rudely awoken to the fact that, oh, there's this place in this cave on Abandawe, or as they said, Abandawe. So there's two. Well, it's a big deal to find one. Don't get me wrong, but it's not that big of a deal that there may be a stone circle or a portal near them. As soon as you find another one, all freaking bets are off. All bets are off because what, Scottish Highlands and then like middle of the tropical places? You know what I'm saying?
But see, here's what I take away from that. Girl wasted so much money on a plane flight back over to Scotland when she just could have found some stone circles on the United States. That flight's expensive, y'all.
You mean when she went back in time?
Yes.
The second time. Yeah, but like I said, that's all we, for almost three full books, that's the only one we know about. So I take it back. I was like, oh, so our world hasn't been really, well, okay. The shifting, and I could be wrong that there wasn't, okay, there may have been another shift between chapters 1 and 22. I don't remember them, but they very well could exist. But one of the major shifts we had in book 3 was that Abandawe existed, right? That there was another portal. And so having a portal here in chapter 23, again, not really a world shift. It's just more of the same. We're getting a confirmation of what was already introduced to us and that there are more than one. The world shift, the shift is that when we were in Jamaica, or I should say all of book 1 and 2 and 3, the time travelers we meet Claire and we meet Galus, correct?
For sure, those are the ones for sure. But the thing that she should really start paying attention to is that all of the time travelers that she's running into meet Grizzly Ends.
Heck yeah.
Right now we're 2 for 2 with beheadings, and that's just the ones we know about. So, and you should start thinking, what did they do that I did not? And why am I still alive? And how long did they survive? Now, Galus lasted a very long time on her wits alone, but we don't know how long this headless filling dude existed in the past. Or where he came from, or how long he was there before somebody chopped his head off.
Yeah, we don't know his timeline. So the one thing I'll say about this chapter or this book thus far is that the first time, well, I don't remember every single detail of chapters 1 through 22, but I think so far, this is the biggest, not clash, but the biggest deal thus far. And that is, we're in the new world. It's not a guarantee, but it's a pretty sure bet that if you have a TT, then you have stones somewhat close. Because, and also don't forget, it's not just, well, okay, if it weren't this, she probably would not have been able to tell it was a TT, but it's not just any TT, it's a TT from around her time because of the fillings. So if it had been anyone else, she wouldn't have known. You know what I mean? She wouldn't have known it was TT. As always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.